Shadow IT describes solutions developed or acquired by users rather than an organization's IT group. While many equate shadow IT with problems, some argue there are benefits organizations can accrue from the practices falling under that label. Against this background, today we are going to discuss shadow IT in the enterprise, and we're going to talk about the best way for organizations to both exploit and manage these kinds of solutions. We'll also talk about how Microsoft's growing policies around enabling features by default and making it easier for employees to buy and use products via pay-as-you-go licenses may possibly exacerbate shadow IT, and how and if companies should try to thwart these changes. Welcome to the seventh episode in a series of Directions on Microsoft podcasts that we call Brainstorm. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the Editor-in-Chief here at Directions. I'm your host for this series, where our analysts discuss emerging topics on Microsoft's products, services, and most importantly, strategies. Brainstorm is your chance to look at how the analysts at Directions on Microsoft do what we do. Twice weekly, the analysts hold scope meetings where we talk about the tech news of the week, reports we're working on, and the best ways to deliver the information that our customers need to know. Brainstorm is meant to give you a front row seat to one of these scope meetings. Today's roundtable features Barry Briggs, who covers CIO topics, AI, enterprise architecture, and corporate governance, Greg DiMichele, who covers compute and data infrastructure, and Rob Sanfilippo, who covers Copilots, Power Platform, Visual Studio, and SQL Server. Thanks so much, guys. Let's get right into question one. Shadow IT has often been considered the bane of enterprise IT because it's IT that central organizations do not control. Why does enterprise IT look askance at shadow IT? What can go wrong? What kinds of governance are essential? These are the big questions. And I'm going to start with Barry, because as the former CTO of Microsoft's own IT unit, this must have been a big topic on your agenda.
Yeah, thanks, Mary Jo. Yeah, it certainly was. You know, when we look at it, you know, what, as CTO of Microsoft's own IT organization, and, you know, I was responsible for the safety, the security, the scalability, and the quality of something like 2,000 applications. And the way we accomplished that was through things like standards that we developed, through architectural reviews, through formal architecture review boards, which I ran, which could run hours for a given critical application and so forth. You know, and all that meant was that applications took a certain amount of time to build. And, you know, the net was that people outside of IT saw that enterprise IT was slow. It was expensive. You know, it was also compliant and scalable and met the appropriate standards and so forth, and evolvable and so forth. You know, so there was this kind of dichotomy. And right. So business units would say, oh, I'll write my own apps. You know, I know a vendor, you know, or I got a guy in my organization. There's a guy in the corner who knows the connection string to the SQL server that has the data that I need. Let me just write my own. And fair enough, right? Because sometimes they have critical pressing business needs to get an application out quickly. Right. Well, then happens, of course, is, you know, over time, the application grows, the business unit doesn't have any the budget anymore to maintain those applications. They might be issues discovered with GDPR or PCI or FISMA or whatever standard. You know, they might actually be corrupting the data that they snuck out of the enterprise application. So ultimately, they say, "Dear enterprise IT, could you please take over my app because I can't afford to deal with it anymore?" And enterprise IT says, "Okay, fine, but can you give me budget to do?" And they say no. And anyway, the circle goes round and round and round. And that's kind of a conundrum of shadow IT, I think.
Right. Okay, so we've got the history down here. Let's talk about Power Platform, because I feel like when Power Platform emerged onto the scene, things like Power Apps, Power Automate, this is when a lot of companies really started noticing what they were considering to be shadow IT, right? These tools can help with development backlogs, but they're a little too easy to purchase and deploy, some people felt like. And then you have the citizen developers who are building apps with them. If they happen to leave the organization, they can result in abandoned apps, unsupported apps. And so I'm curious if you on the panel think the benefits of how a Power Platform works and how it's licensed and deployed outweighs the potential downsides. And I got to start with Rob on this one.
Cool. Well, thanks, Mary Jo. Power Apps and Flow, which was renamed Power Automate. So those things were released almost a decade ago. It was in 2015. And I remember at the time these technologies were announced, most of us at Directions thought, uh-oh, here's a huge new source of shadow IT. Mm-hmm. And we weren't the only ones who thought that. Yet, this wasn't even the first offering of its kind from Microsoft. If you look at tools from the company that make it easy for non-IT people to create apps, it goes back to the original Visual Basic, and then you had Access and Light Switch and Visual Basic for Applications. You always had all the macro languages in most Office apps too, that just made it easy for end users to write their own code, which could then proliferate and become critical for teams to use. And so all these tools can lure motivated power users to build things that might be better left to the IT department, especially in terms of security, quality, and support. But for Power Apps and Power Automate, which are now part of the Power Platform line, which offers even more citizen developer low and no-code tools like Copilot Studio, they've proliferated and garnered a significant customer base. And these tools offer a trade-off for line-of-business app development. They simplify creation of certain apps, but they don't provide the advanced capabilities available with pro code programming languages, such as direct access to APIs and procedural code for implementing algorithms. However, Power Platform capabilities are sufficient for many focused business processes, and using it cuts the overhead of tasking dev teams to build formal solutions. And that work can be delegated to the business teams that will use the apps and have the best understanding of the requirements. However, you got administrators, and they must establish policies and control access to Power Platform dev tools, which apps are published and who can use those published apps and the data behind them, not to mention the surprisingly complex and often changing licensing scheme Power Platform employs. So it depends on whether this trade-off of new policies, processes, and oversight for a reduced burden on pro dev teams and new costs is worth it for an organization. And the answer to that, it's not going to be the same for every organization. So each one has to decide, they have to all consider their objectives and budgets to make that decision.
Yep, for sure. Barry, you want to chime in here?
Yeah, maybe 2 points to make. One is, Rob mentioned Power Automate, and it's kind of interesting because Microsoft has been swinging at this workflow ball for decades, right? I mean, BizTalk, Windows Workflow Foundation, Flow, SharePoint Workflow, blah, blah, blah. In fact, I was originally hired to work on this as it happened. You know why they have, some of them have failed, some of them have been marginally successful. You know, the interesting thing is that when we think about it, you know, at the very highest level, what's a business? A business is just a collection of business processes. And that's all it is. What else is it? And so we think about, Power Automate, UiPath, and so forth. So far, they've only been able to really help us with relatively simple automated departmental flows, right? And maybe that's good enough. Maybe that's good enough for, I doubt, honestly, that Power Automate could scale. They say, overall, at a corporate level, you have an order to cash flow, or a hire to retire flow. I'm not sure the Power Automate's really up to something at that level of scale. But certainly for, automating a very simple flow, I think it's certainly possible. Which brings me to my second point, which is that, over on the whole, I think Microsoft is very, very good at applications, right? But they kind of steered clear at the enterprise ecosystem level, right? And what do I mean by that? So Power App in sales, for in a sales department, for example, might have a totally different definition of what a customer is than a Power App in support.
Right.
I might have, you know, two separate siloed applications with two definitions of a core data domain. So, you know, what I'm really talking about is that mythical thing that we call an enterprise data model. And we've been chasing this for years and years and years, but now I'd argue it's actually increasingly critical because all this data is actually getting smooshed into a warehouse or a lakehouse like Fabric or Snowflake or Databricks, you know, for use by AI, right? So this is something I think we're coming to an inflection point where we're going to have to start thinking about things like this at an enterprise level.
Greg, I'm very interested in your take here because you're coming at it from a different perspective, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I mean a couple things. One thing that leaps to my mind is, I mean, I get a little bit allergic when we talk about citizen developer because it's lumping a huge range of people, skill sets, personas under one term. Like if you're within Microsoft, a quote unquote citizen developer is probably a software engineer with a degree in computer science. If it's at Google, they've probably got three PhDs. If they're at, you know, your average enterprise, they're very different. So I think, and even within your typical enterprise, you have data science teams that don't live in IT, that live in the departments, but who are building mission critical systems. So I think the word shadow IT or citizen developer, I think we have to, you know, get a little bit more nuance about what we're talking about.
Right.
Okay. The second thing I would add is shadow IT actually does IT a lot of favors. If the central IT team had to deliver on every single macro, script, batch, bash shell, that every department used had to go to IT to be created, IT would collapse under the burden of all that. So like a certain amount of this is good because it keeps the IT team focused on, you know, some of the things that they have to do. So I think it's also important that we don't try to say we're going to, Barry, you did not say this, but so I don't mean to imply you did, but there's this attitude sometimes you can see, which is we have to stamp out shadow IT.
Right.
Be careful what you wish for there. and I guess the last thing I would say about the no code, low code, I mean, I agree with everything folks said, but I think the biggest issue I have with low code / no code tools is the hard part of coding is not the syntax of Java, or maybe it is JavaScript because JavaScript's an abomination. But the hard part about programming is the rigorously logical thinking, the error handling. And so my fear about most low-code, no-code tools is they automate the part that's not the actual hard part. So I think if companies are going to enable those sorts of things, there is a bit of, you know, I hate to say training is the answer to everything, but there is something you have to do to ground people on, you know, what happens if this goes wrong and what are the guardrails you can put in place. So I just have a bit of a bugaboo about a lot of low code, no code tools just on that front. Barry, I think come at me.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's actually the instinctive reaction of enterprise IT to try to stamp out shadow IT, right? I mean, it's just instinctive, but it's, you know, as we've all learned, it's the wrong attitude because they're just things that, you know, the business units can build because they have to, because they don't have time to go through all the rigor of enterprise IT. The real challenge is to do that in a way, you know, that there are guardrails, that the data is protected and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, our colleague, Michael Cherry, wrote an article actually about my old group called about how Microsoft Digital, as it's now called, approaches its shadow IT in a more, I would say, controlled or mature fashion than perhaps we might have earlier.
Okay. All right. Now I want to talk about another part of something that used to be part of the Power Platform, Power Virtual Agents. Now that's called Copilot Studio. And that product is meant to help users create agents within their own organizations, among other things. So With Microsoft making agents and other AI technologies very easy to purchase and use with things like pay-as-you-go and on by default, I'm wondering whether these kinds of technologies could become another form of shadow IT and be somewhat problematic. So I'm curious what you three think. Is this a risk? And is there anything organizations can and should do to try to mitigate this? Who would like to start on that one?
Well, I'll let others comment on the licensing issues because that's not really my area of expertise. But I think, you know, as I commented in my AI strategy video, we're really in the very early stages of AI adoption. And we have yet to see kind of the full flowering of what AI and agents really can do. And that having been said, no, I've seen some pretty remarkable real-world apps built on Copilot Studio. But for me, at least, here's the deal. It's still the same issue as with any shadow app. And the core issue with shadow apps is, are they, in my opinion, how are they allowed to write to systems of record? And if they are, that's a danger, I think. And if it can be monitored, maybe, if it can be audited, maybe. But writing to systems of record by people or by applications that aren't controlled and audited by central IT is a potential risk.
Okay. Rob?
About reading versus writing. I think that is a key distinction.
Sure. Rob, would you like to?
Sure. Well, you know, Copilot Studio's actually in my area. I've written several reports about it. It was over a year ago that it got renamed from Power Virtual Agents Copilot Studio, and they added generative AI to it. So it just became massively more powerful when the generative AI got added in, because previous to that, you could build these agents, but they were very heavily scripted. Like, you had to consider every scenario and pathway. And if something didn't fall into one of these so-called topics you created, it would just default to saying, oh, sorry, ask your question in a different way. But now it's got generative AI as of a year ago. And, you know, another thing they've done is they've been changing the branding around this. And so now the things you create with it is agents instead of, they were calling them copilots or extensions or plugins. So you're creating agents with Copilot Studio. I think the risks of adopting Copilot Studio and allowing deployment of these agents can't be denied, because it makes it really easy to bring that generative AI together with your internal processes, which it can be very powerful to streamline business tasks, but it can open security and compliance holes. And not to mention it can incur significant costs that are now driven by a new pay-as-you-go meter, which is just barely a month old. And then it also will require new admin policies and processes to keep that in control. So orgs going down this road, it can be very tempting. This is where you can get a lot of value out of, especially 365 Copilot, is if you build agents to extend it for your own really specific needs. But if you're going down that road, you need to spend the leads, the managerial departments and IT staff, they need to spend the effort to learn what controls they have over these tools, and also to learn the licensing details. And again, these have just recently changed in the last month, and some customers I've been talking to missed these announcements entirely, and they're shocked to find out, oh, these meters are running now, and we have this turned on. Uh-oh, we better go back and check on that. Definitely. So a lot of things to think about there, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I saw just this week, Microsoft put out a note in the message center, the admin message center for Microsoft 365, and said, by the way, we're turning on self-service for Microsoft 365 Copilots for people with a variety of plans. So that if you have one of these, you're going to see a little box show up in your tenant. And you're going to say, hey, do you want to buy Microsoft 365 Copilot? And so I think a lot of administrators who haven't already kind of thought ahead and used a PowerShell module or some other way to block that are going to be surprised to start seeing people buying Copilot.
Right. Yeah. It can get very expensive.
It can.
It's $30 per user per month.
Right. And like you said, people who don't really know, you know, how the organization wants to administer it, just kind of like, oh, let me plug in here and let me do this and that. And if there aren't guardrails, again, there could be issues, right?
But again, I want us to also acknowledge the reality, which is ChatGPT is a web tab away. You know
right,
what I mean?
Sure.
So I think, Barry or Rob, you said if you go down this road, you have to go down this road, because I bet many IT managers would be shocked the number of their employees, particularly fairly senior, has paid ChatGPT subscriptions and are just copying and pasting information into ChatGPT to get their jobs done because they find they're more productive. And what are you going to do? You know, disable the copy and paste keys? You know, so I think it's important. The answer, when these innovation waves come like AI, the answer can't be, I'm just going to shut it all off.
No,
it's jello. You're going to squeeze the jello and it's going to pop out somewhere else. I think you have to figure out, how do I say yes to this in some way? Now, maybe it's not through paying Microsoft $30 a month. I don't know, you know, the form it takes, but you have to figure out how your answer is yes, and this is how, as opposed to no, because then all you're doing, particularly for a generation of employees who've grown up just with the web as a given, who know that they can go and, you know, try free subscriptions or free SaaS apps or free whatevers. I don't underestimate how much of this is happening already, and that your locking it down doesn't actually prevent it. It just makes it unknown.
That's a great point. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, right? It's out. All right. Good point for me to take a quick break so that I can talk about a series of podcasts that we recorded that are specifically about EAs, or enterprise agreements. So Directions on Microsoft created a 6-part podcast series where we featured various members of our advisory services team, led by Dean Bedwell, all about Microsoft EA negotiation. Before he joined Directions, Dean spent 11 years at Microsoft managing the Canadian business desk, where he was responsible for negotiating agreements with Microsoft's largest enterprise and public sector customers. So he obviously knows what he's talking about. In our series, we discuss everything from project management to discovery, analysis, strategies for getting discounts, concessions, negotiation levers, all of the parts of the process. Whether you're brand new to the EA negotiation process or a veteran who wants to hear more about all the tips and tricks that we've discovered over the years, you should check out our EA negotiation podcast series. To find it, go to directionsonmicrosoft.com/podcast or visit our Directions on Microsoft YouTube channel and listen to the full series for free. Okay, back to the panel. Let's talk. We've been talking around this point, but let's talk directly about it now. Let's talk about the policies, procedures, and tools that make for sound corporate behavior around things like Power Platform and Copilot Studio. Let's start with Barry. Barry, what tools and services like Purview, which I know you've covered a lot in the past, are available that could help IT manage shadow IT?
Yeah, well, first, a little history. You know, when I was, in Microsoft IT, one of the things that we did to support shadow IT, pre-Power Apps and so forth, was we established the principle of trustworthy data. You've heard about trustworthy code. We said, okay, there has to be trustworthy data. So there are recognized places where shadow applications can extract data, and we'll help you get that in a trustworthy way. But that really raises kind of the larger point about data governance. In today's world, it's vital. And that's why you see, you know, chief data officers, even chief AI officers now emerging as new roles in organizations. The key point here is that organizations really have to learn how to manage their data state, you know, all of the data, right? With controls, like things like the things that Purview provides, like sensitivity labels and encryptions and permissions and access controls and so forth. And, you know, you mentioned Purview, Mary Jo. I personally think that Purview is just this amazing hidden gem in the Microsoft portfolio. It's received just an incredible amount of investment, really flying under the radar. It has come a long, long way in the past 5 years as I've been watching it, for being the tool to help do the data governance job. However, the tool is just one part of it. The organization has to be trained, right? The organization, the awareness has to be raised about the importance of data, as Greg mentioned before, about you don't copy and paste from ChatGPT, please don't do that. You know, things like that, you have to make sure that your sensitive data is appropriately protected so that, you know, if an HR person puts all the salaries up in some SharePoint that nobody knows about, well, guess what, Copilot does know about it. So, mm-hmm. All this is all about, carefully deployed data governance. It's super important.
Okay. Rob, anything to add on Power Platform specifically?
I do, actually. I'm going to be very specific about a particular feature called managed environments, which when I talk to customers about Power Platform Manage, I always emphasize that a lot of them have heard of it, some haven't, but this is a hidden gem of a feature, and it requires additional licensing beyond the Power Platform rights that are included with Microsoft 365. So you might have to buy Power Apps Premium, for example, to get this. There's a few other ways to do it, but it can be well worth it for these significantly enhanced governance controls that it provides. So these things called managed environments, and they're different from the standard environments, which are just called environments, that are included in the base offerings. These upgraded managed environments bring at least a dozen extra capabilities that can help administrators wrangle control over their Power Platform deployments. And it includes things like app sharing limitation controls and improved grouping of environments that gives you the ability to nest environments. And it also you can receive usage reports that summarize the popular Power Apps that the org has deployed and the makers behind them. There's probably 10 more features. Is a huge list, some around security. Really great stuff. So that's the one thing I want to point out. This is a good platform to do that. Take a look at managed environments if you're planning your Power Platform policies and processes, because that's really going to give you a significant amount of governance over that stuff.
Okay, great. All right, let's round up this discussion. And we've kind of already, again, touched on this, but is shadow IT always a bad idea? Or is there some merit in making coding and other kinds of tools more readily accessible, as long as administrators can keep tabs, at least some degree, on who has access to and is paying for them? I want to start with Greg, because I can guess I know what he's going to say, but let me see. Go ahead.
I think organizations now are so large, so diverse, so complex that IT would collapse if it literally had to meet every demand that's being fulfilled through a variety of self-service mechanisms. And to try to stamp it out, it's like, in the first Star Wars movies, Princess Leia says, the more you tighten your grip, the more star systems will slip through your fingers. And I think that applies here. The more you lock things down, the more incentive you create for people to just throw up their hands and go, okay, fine, I'll just go and use this public website to do something, or I'll use, ChatGPT or Claude or whatever. It's not just individual workers. It'll come from your C-suite and your executives. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you think the iPad and the iPhone got into most corporations? It's because somebody with a C-level title bought one, brought it in, and handed it to IT and said, okay, make this thing work. So sometimes good things come up through it. So I think the name of the game here, and Barry touched on this, is you have to be ahead of where your rank and file are. You need to be able to sort of look around the corner a bit and say, hey, I know that this is going to be catnip to some people, and they're going to want to start using it. I'm not just going to tell them no. I'm going to, provide an alternative that I support. So, yeah, I think it not only is it not always bad, it's a necessity. Now, does Microsoft sometimes use it to its advantage to try to sneak things in that are then later you have to pay for? Yes, they do. But I think it's a reality you have to live with and figure out how to use as your incubation environment. Rob, what's your take on that?
I agree, and we've been saying things since the beginning is that there's pros and cons of shadow IT, and it has me thinking that it's an unfortunate term at this point, shadow IT. It sounds undesirable or seedy or rogue, which is what it originally was referring to whenever that term was devised. But I think it's still being applied to productive stuff that's happening, as we've talked about. Power Platform is huge. Organizations, they know it could lead to shadow IT, but it outweighs that with all the capabilities and the modern kinds of tools that you can empower people with. So, yeah, I just think it's not necessarily a bad thing, and that the term makes it sound bad, but it's got a lot of pros and cons.
Yep. Good point. On the naming. I agree with the naming. Even calling things like Pagey, pay-as-you-go and on by default, calling those shadow IT, it's a stretch, right? But it could result in some of the behaviors of the traditional shadow IT. So, yeah.
So let me just chime in for a second.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with anything that anybody said, but, speaking as someone who was the representative of Central Enterprise IT, the core issue here is damage to the systems of record, right? You do not want to have to restate earnings because somebody with a shadow IT app over here wrote something to your ERP system that they really shouldn't have. And so, I'm not saying that we want to limit the agility of business units, but the guardrails are absolutely critical.
Yep, good point. All right, we're going to take one more quick break before we go to our next two segments of the show, which are customer question and hot button. So I wanted to open with a question. Did you know that Directions on Microsoft has a YouTube channel where we are posting podcasts like this one? We also just added a couple of new videos to the channel that you probably won't want to miss. One of them is from our analyst and co-founder, Rob Horowitz, who is kicking off a new Microsoft Licensing Basics series on our YouTube channel. He's got his first part of that up now, which is called Units of Measure. And this is all about how Microsoft charges customers for its products and services. So Rob, in this video, covers everything from per user licensing to per device licensing, capacity, consumption. He talks about the different licenses and the concerns around them that you need to know about. And we also have a brand new video from Barry Briggs, who is on our show today, where he talks in depth about Microsoft's AI strategy. And he covers everything in this 1 hour video. It's amazing what he packs in here. He's got the processor part of it, co-pilots, agents, RAG, apps, models, AI dev and management tools, and more. So if you want to make sure you don't miss any of these new content, these new kinds of content, subscribe today to our YouTube channel, and you can find it at youtube.com/@directionsonmicrosoft. Okay, now we are at the customer questions segment, where we talk about a question that we received from one of our members. We don't talk about the member's name or the company or the location, but we just talk about the question and how we would answer this. So we had an enterprise customer contact directions fairly recently with a question that is very much on theme with today's discussion. Their question was, we have developed an application which runs on a Windows-based device that's logged in. But instead of a user working on the device, a bot is performing an automated process to control Office apps to perform a repetitive task. And because there's no human user on this device, we're wondering, does it need to be licensed? So who would like to start with this one? Rob, maybe?
Sure. It's actually, as far as the yes or no part of it, it's easy. The answer is yes. You have to pay. And a general rule we usually announce or mention at the beginning of our licensing boot camps is that if you're wondering whether some feature or scenario requires additional licensing, it does. If there's a place for Microsoft to charge for something and that it can be defined in some way, it's going to be charging. So that is the case for these unattended processes. And this actually happens a few places. So there's Power Automate flows that can be run unattended. There's robotic process automation. Greg, you can talk about that. But you know, we were talking about Copilot Studio, and they have these agents now, they're calling them. And there's three types. There's retrieval, task, and autonomous. So the third of those, autonomous, which is just in preview right now, those run on their own in the background, maybe on a schedule, maybe when an event triggers them, but they're not attached to a user. And so you don't just get away for free and have these things running and doing great things for you. You have to pay on a meter. And again, that goes back to what was announced last month with the new pricing they put around Copilot Studio. But you have to pay for these autonomous agents that are running. It can get pricey too, depending on what they're doing, how active they are. But I just want to point out, as far as those agents, if you're going to be using those, you got to pay for the autonomous ones. You can't assign a 365 Copilot license to them. You can only pay for those through a meter that's always running, and depending on what they're doing. And then, yeah, if you're using Power Automate Flow or robotic automation, there's also pricing around that, which is not attached to a specific user. But that's just what I wanted to say about that area.
Yeah, and I don't have much to add because I think Rob's maxim is spot on. If you're ever asking the question, I wonder if I found a loophole that allows me to not have to pay a license, the answer is you haven't. And if you have, it will be closed in the next quickly. That is the directions rule. If you think you found a loophole, you haven't. And if you have, it won't last. I think all these technologies, RPA, you know, call it agentic computing. Clearly, we're heading into a world where computers are going to do things using other computers as opposed to us using them. And I think the idea of that is going to impact the way Microsoft approaches licensing of these technologies, because it's not going to make sense to be per user when, you know, a user might be, you know, effectively remote controlling 10 other systems. So, but the bottom line is, Microsoft's going to get its portion of that. It doesn't matter whether you call it RPA or chat agents or Flow or whatever.
All right. Let's go to our last segment of the show, which we call Hot Buttons. Here, I ask each of you, what are you looking at in the world of Microsoft right now? Anything catching your eye? Any new reports you're digging into, or any topic you're really obsessed with right now? Who wants to start? Greg, maybe?
Well, yeah, mine's a little bit of a rant.
Rants are okay, you know, for, also.
For those who don't know, you know, I spent a decade at Microsoft, but then the decade post that has been, you know, in the at Google and in the world of G Suite and Google Docs as a collaboration. So this has really been my first return to the world of Office Docs and Office collaboration. And I got to say, you know, using a real Windows or Mac app instead of, you know, an Electron wrapped browser app, I'm kind of digging PowerPoint and Excel and Word on that part. But the whole collaboration experience is still so woeful. Yes. You know, the colleague and I were just working on a webinar and two people with a PowerPoint opened at the same time. PowerPoint was not happy with the two of us simultaneously editing a document. The fact that when I open a document in Word, I can't touch a paragraph that someone else is in unless I switch to print layout, but not if I'm in web layout. The whole thing is so clearly bolted on, and it's such a shame because the power of a truly collaborative environment where multiple people can simultaneously edit the doc and there's no such thing as saving or folders. So I guess I would just, for folks who've never looked at the world of Google Docs and Google Suites, I'm not suggesting you abandon Office, let's face it. But I think Microsoft could do so much more to really make the collaboration part of Office 365 and SharePoint first class. And it's just not at the moment, unfortunately. So that's a bit of a bee in my bonnet at this point.
I know. I think this topic is part of the reason Microsoft came out with Loop right? Because
yeah,
they couldn't really pull off the collaboration at the level of some of their competitors. And they're like, you know, let's just make another app. Let's start over.
And don't forget, we have Copilot Pages now, which is based on Loop, but adds in Copilot.
So exactly. What doesn't add in Copilot anymore, right?
That's true, too.
I'm going to have to give that a more serious look, Rob, because I would love a more collaboration native solution from Microsoft. So I'm going to dig up some of your reports and give Loop a go myself.
Okay, sounds good.
What about you, Rob? Any hot buttons for you this week?
Yeah, I have been looking at some new technology. So, you know, we had Ignite, Microsoft Ignite was in November, and there was a lot of announcements there, certainly around AI. One of the things that came out of that, ever since 365 Copilot went generally available in November of 2023, there was the initial rush to buy enterprises to grab a bunch of licenses of that, which is expensive. But then there was a cool down period where customers were saying, okay, where's the value in this? What am I getting out of all this money? And they also, for those that didn't adopt, they were like, well, should we adopt? Show us some value first. So there's been tools from Microsoft that sort of measure how what kind of value your org might be getting out of Copilot by just counting up how many people are summarizing or drafting emails and how many people are summarizing meetings. And let's just assume they're all saving some amount of time. We'll add that all up, maybe even multiply it by hourly salaries, rates, and just try to show you a number that's being saved. It'd be a soft number, not something that's coming off your budgets, but it's equating with people's time and therefore some money. So one of the things that was announced in November was this Copilot Analytics set of tools. And one of those things is the Copilot Business Outcome Reports, which attempt to correlate Copilot usage with KPIs that you might be measuring, that you should be measuring within your organization. So it does this non-scientific correlation where it says, well, let's look at people that are getting a high win rate of deals in the marketing or in the sales department, and let's see how much they use Copilot. Oh, well, look at this. It looks like they're using a lot of Copilot. Therefore, that's why they're getting such great results at their job. Now, there's nothing to necessarily tie those things together, but that's what these reports attempt to do. So I think these are worth a look. Even if you don't actually use them, just look at the capabilities if you're really looking for measuring the value of 365 Copilot, because it is a earnest attempt by Microsoft to try to show you some value. And then the second thing, it's what we've already been talking about with Copilot Studio and this new pay-as-you-go pay-as-you-go pricing scheme that's just came out in January. Take a look at this, because it also involves a free tier of what they're now calling, help me with this, Mary Jo, is it 365 Copilot Business Chat, I believe?
No, Copilot Chat is the new SKU, if that's what you're talking
it's
about.
It's the SKU, but then you get to use Business Chat
you
as
do.
Part of that. Okay.
Yep.
The word business is in there somewhere. So you get this sort of free tier of 365 Copilot, but you don't get to use it within any of the Office apps. You're mainly driving it against web content. And you can start to use some agents, but when you use them, they're running as a pay-as-you-go feature, so it's not entirely free. And then if you do still have 365 Copilot, you get a lot of free usage, and even including for agents. But if you, again, we talked about autonomous agents, those are never included with 365 Copilot license. So they will always be charged on a pay-as-you-go meter separately. Anyway, there's a lot of details around this. And then Copilot Studio uses this unit called Messages, which measures the kind of, it's trying to put a price to the responses that agents are returning. And so those can add up. So you need to, it's yet another model you need to understand if you're going down the Copilot Studio and agents path. So that would be another hot area for me, is that because I've talked to some customers even last week, this week even, and they haven't heard about this. And this was announced January 15th, and it could mean that you're getting charged for some things that you might not realize.
Right, right. Good one. good okay. That people keep their eyes open for that.
Definitely.
All right, Barry, what about you?
So I'm sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm a big picture guy. Okay. And as you know, I've been looking at Microsoft AI strategy all up, listening to what a lot of Microsoft executives are saying. And I think they're saying something that is paradigm shift. And it's subtle, but it's very, very significant. And I think what they're saying is we are redefining the whole notion of what an application is, right? We're going to talk more about this, Mary Jo, in our podcast in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But the idea here is, this is a teaser, is that in the old days, we thought of, well, there's persistent data and business logic and UI layers, the three-tier model. Now Microsoft is saying, wait a minute, the UI layer, that's Copilot. But all it is, Copilot, all that is the UI layer to applications, beneath the which there are LLMs and maybe some procedural logic. And beneath that, there's data, and a lot of it. Some of it's in relational transactional databases, some of it's in NoSQL databases, some of it's in lakehouses, and so on. And you program these applications not in procedural code, but in English. And so I believe what Satya is saying in some of his keynotes is that over time, the amount of procedural code decreases over time, and the amount of agentic code increases over time. So a CRM application consists of a whole bunch of agents that capture what a customer is saying, that directs it to the right customer service rep, or finds the right knowledge in the knowledge base, returns it automatically to the user, and so on. That's a teaser for both my AI strategy video and for our podcast in a few weeks. But this is a tectonic change that they're proposing. Now, you may not believe it. A lot of people don't. But I think that's what they're proposing, and it's fascinating. And that's my hot button.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It almost sounds, when I've heard them discuss this, I don't know why I have this in my head, but I feel like it's a bunch of Lego blocks all clicking together to make something bigger. And like the different agents are the blocks, and then they're going to create something like, I don't know, something amazing out of Legos, like the Chrysler building.
I've actually talked to people who are saying they want to build applications only using AI agents with procedural code whatsoever. Wow. And large scale, like a CRM, like a customer service application, for example, the entire app is just a bunch of interconnected agents. And we'll talk more about that in March.
All righty. Sounds good. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. That was a really good panel. I loved it. I want to remind our listeners that they can find lots more coverage of all things Microsoft related on directions on Microsoft.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you have questions, comments, or any topics that you would like to hear the directions analysts cover in one of these podcasts, please do not hesitate to contact me via X or Blue Sky. We at Directions have converged our existing social media channels into a single platform, so give us a follow on X at Directions MSFT, or on Blue Sky at Directions on Microsoft.com for all the latest Microsoft Enterprise product and licensing information. Thanks again.